at Home Club, episode 12. We are recording this on the 26th of November, 2018, and we are releasing it on the 4th of December, 2018. I've still managed to get things a bit bunched up and confused because of HibanaCon and our live show, which I released. But this is your fortnightly look at manga with a focus on joint discussion with myself, Elliot Page, and my ever lovely co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I've consumed way too much pizza today, if such a thing is possible.
No such thing exists.
I feel like I've consumed too much pizza, so we'll see how this goes. If you hear snoring noises, it's probably just my like pizza nap time has somehow come upon me. So please don't take it personally.
Pizza nap time sounds so good. It's like the problem is you also get the pizza sweats where you realize you have eaten too much pizza. Younger days, I would buy like one of those extra large pizzas, eat half of it, and then stick it in the oven for breakfast next morning, and then feel like a complete scumbag.
Yeah, I'm pleased to say I've not done that, so I guess that's a small mercy.
Yeah, reheated barbecue based pizza is something that no one should eat, and yet everyone should try, if that makes sense. Cool. So we're looking at manga. There's a whole heap of crazy black quote-unquote Black Friday deals going on right now, which probably won't be the case anymore when this comes out, so I won't torment you all with them. But guess who's been buying more manga? But we're going to be talking about two series today and also some returning champions. So one quick thing about the podcast. We are now going on for a few months of doing this. You can support us if you wish on Patreon. We've had amazing support from people so far, and it's taken care of our hosting bill quite handily. And the rest of it goes into a kitty for buying series to record on. You can support us from as little as $1 a month, and that gets you access to bonus episodes, one of which we're going to record shortly after recording this one. And also if you donate, I think if you pledge $3 or more a month, you get to vote on what is the topic of the bonus episode. So you too can join some of the wonderful, lovely, awful people, who have recommended me to read more light novels. Although I'm also causing that problem myself, anyway, so we'll see. We did sign up for light novels when we started this podcast, so it's our own damn fault, frankly. So, moving on to the podcast in general, first and foremost, we have the returning champions feature. Full admission, this is the also known as the Elliot Page holding up conversations section, because we have Dead Dead Demons DDDD Destruction Volume 3 and Volume 2 of the Voynich Hotel on here, but I haven't read them yet, even though I've bought them and they're sat on my tablet. So apologies, Andy, but I will get to that and talk about those just as soon as I read them. Sorry.
They're well worth waiting for, so it's all good in the end.
I like to think that by bottling you up like this and making you hold on to your comments, I'm just marinating you somehow.
Yes, either that or I will just forget everything that happened in them.
No, don't do that. No. Oh, God. Okay, no, I'm going to read them, I swear. Right, well, next episode. I have continued to read A Bride Story, which, Andy, you've reassured me you're not going to continue with. So Bride Story continues. I've read volumes 2 and 3. The art continues to be luscious. It does the thing where it kind of starts to move the camera a little more in terms of what it shows you. You have the continuing travails of Amir and her like previous family, her birth family, and the sort of problems regarding that, which, you know, kind of crescendo in different ways. And then the camera starts to move to view more people around the household and their travails and other sort of characters who come and go. And also, you know, the anthropologist dude, Mr. Smith, the dude. So the camera then starts to follow him, and he is called away to Ankara on business to pick up a delivery. And he gets into a whole heap of trouble, wife related trouble. Dun, dun, dun. it kind of has a really strange sort of little arc about that, where you start to read it and you think, man, this is getting a bit sort of easy and saccharine, and then whoop, nope, oh sorry, you fall on your face because I pulled the rug from under you. And yeah, it's kind of an interesting little bit, excuse me, because you also get the rest of the cast in on it, and it kind of has an interesting sort of section, and it reinforces something the rest of the series does, where it's like, you know, it's all well and good looking back on it with 21st century eyes, but you know, this is 200 years ago. Things are very different. Things are like, you know, there are structures in place that seem alien and are alien to us. But yeah, it's got a lot of very interesting, cute stuff with the characters. You've got Amir continuing to be kind of adorable and a bit weird. She is, again, magic pixie dream girl, just, you know, Caucasus edition. So yeah, I'm still enjoying it. I need to finish and other things to read volume 4, but I've kind of put myself on notice to finish other series I'm reading before I continue to buy more of this. But you can get up to volume 9 now, which has been released, and given how it's quite effortlessly been expanding its scope and becoming a little more relaxed in how it handles everything, I'm looking forward to it, because it does feel a lot less stiff now in how much it focuses on, like how much it focused on Amir, and now is like, okay, there's an entire breadth of culture here to absorb, so we can just sort of slowly ease off on that without fear of losing the audience. I'm enjoying it in that regard. The art is still crazy good. Like, it's kind of ridiculous in how beautiful it is, especially with the clothing, because man alive, Karen Morin must have like arm muscles like a mother, frankly. Amount of drawing. Oh dear. But no, I'm enjoying it still. I'm also planning to reread Emma at some point, but again, that's probably going to be like over my break for Christmas at this point.
Yeah.
I'm glad we don't do like an award show of some kind, although I keep thinking about wanting to do one. It's like, oh no, dude, remember how much of a pain they are.
yeah, like for manga in particular, like it's a really weird thing because there's just so much of it and so much breadth. It's like, you know, where do you even start with it?
You go slightly mad, I feel, just from the get-go. Cool. But yeah, that's A Bride Story. I'm greatly enjoying it. Still available. We're in all good places. Kobo is probably your best bet because it's cheaper there, frankly. But yeah, really enjoying it. So cool. Moving on to our main section. I've been gabbing way too much already, Andy. Would you mind taking your choice first?
Yeah, sure thing. Yeah, so my choice for this podcast was Forest of Piano, aka Piano Normali, which I think is probably what a lot of people will know it better as, because it's kind of been it's been around for a while and it's kind of kicked around under its Japanese title. I didn't realize, actually, I literally just checked that the Netflix original anime adaptation is actually out now. That kind of snuck under the radar while I was busy with other things. So that was kind of what prompted me to finally read this, because I feel like it's a series that has been, I've heard people talking around the fringes of it a lot over many, many years and kind of have never delved any deeper. So I kind of use this as an opportunity to do that. And basically the story is the story of a kid called Shuhei Amamiya. He's been learning to play the piano since he was 4, and he's kind of one of those kids, in inverted commas, who's basically kind of been pushed into it by his parents. Like, they've very much kind of told him, like, no, this is a thing that you should do, and they've kind of forced him to keep up with it. And, you know, he's good at it, but it's not something that he has any real love for. He loves it because he's good at it, rather than kind of naturally loving it because it's something that he enjoys doing. And kind of being that sort of slightly kind of posh kid with a slightly kind of unusual pastime, of course, he becomes kind of the subject of bullying at his school. In particular, he's the subject of this bully called Kinpilla, who, you know, is kind of as a new student as well. Like, they are, said bully is very much into kind of making him the butt of any kind of jokes and focus for his own kind of his own ends and for his own amusement. And alongside that, there's another kid in this class called Kai Ichinose, who is basically like the one kid that ends up standing up for Shuhei in the midst of all this bullying. He's clearly a kid who has himself been bullied. Like, he comes from a very poor upbringing, and of course, bullies being bullies, they make no kind of, they don't pull any punches when it comes to letting everybody know about that and about, you know, his kind of parentage, et cetera, et cetera. But the whole thing kind of revolves around, it ends up revolving around what seems like kind of a tall tale, because there's this sort of almost urban myth, it seems like, about this piano in the forest that's probably haunted, because of course, like, any piano in a forest is going to be haunted. Like, that just, you know, that just scans. And basically, kind of, Shuhei gets sort of given the challenge of, like, you've got to go into this forest and play this piano and kind of and prove it. And
Kaya, or whip your dick out.
Yes, yeah. Or the alternative, yes, is show everybody your penis because kids are obsessed with genitals.
Yeah, the school bully is worth noting is like the manga school bully, given that he himself is quite fat and like he exists only to be a bully. And as soon as anyone pushes back, he crumbles instantaneously.
Yeah.
He has a very small toolbox of like, hey, play the piano, fuck you, and get your dick out. And it's like, man, you suck as a bully. What a prick.
Yeah, yeah. But also somewhat like analogous to many school bullies, I suspect.
Oh no, he's effective as well because no one else stands up to him apart from Kai, and everyone else kind of end arounds him in a weird way.
Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. So the rest of the class are like, whatever, this fucking idiot.
You know? Yeah, so Kai is basically the one kid who's willing to kind of go toe-to-toe with him in terms of both kind of being abusive and kind of pushing back on his bullshit and coming to blows if required. But Kai basically kind of chimes in about this weird piano in the forest and kind of insists that it's a piano that you can actually play and it'll kind of make a sound, which kind of makes no sense to anybody else because it's like, you know, it's this old abandoned piano that's clearly going to be like dilapidated. How would it possibly make any kind of sound? But as things turn out, kind of Shuhei and Kai end up going to said piano. Shuhei cannot get any sound out of the piano, but Kai, as he promises, can. Like he can play music on it. And that's kind of the center point around which everything revolves from that point. Like there's the music teacher for these kids, who, as it turns out, also kind of has a part to play and has a history with this weird piano. And then it's also just kind of about Kai and Shuhei's relationship, kind of coming from very different walks of life, and they have a very different kind of viewpoint on kind of music and the playing of music. Like, you know, Kai just does it because it's fun. Shuhei does it because he has to. And there's this sort of this weird sort of intermingling between the two where they're both just kind of fascinated with each other in a certain sense because they are just very different people even though they have some kind of similarities to them. And I mean, I think that the one thing that I really like about this series is the way that it plays with the kind of the tall tales that kids tell each other, whether it's to try and scare each other or for dares or whatever. Like this, the whole way it plays up this kind of piano in the forest, it's sort of this believable kind of like urban myth that is somehow built up around these kids and around kind of like generations of kids at this school. And sort of as it turns out, you know, there is actually some truth to it. But there's sort of a feeling throughout in terms of kind of the way these kids talk about various things. You're never quite sure where the truth begins and ends with it. It's like a lot of the stuff, you know, even the stuff that kind of Kin Pillar uses as his ammunition to bully Kai in particular, like to start with, you're not entirely sure whether any of that is legitimate or whether he's just kind of talking bullshit to kind of try and turn people against Kai. And again, kind of the truth is sort of somewhere in the middle of those two things. So I kind of really like the way that it uses the fact that its characters are kids in kind of a believable way, rather than kind of some series tend to write kids as being too mature or something like that, just for kind of, you know, just for the conveniences of the plot. Whereas all of the kids in this series, for the most part, feel like kids of that age group, like from the way that they are jerks and bully each other to the way that they don't kind of pull any punches when it comes to, you know, upsetting and offending, etc., one another. And like all of that kind of just feels very real to me.
Yeah, you get it a lot. I feel like you get it quite a lot, especially with Kai, because, you know, he is a very much zero filter character. And it kind of makes it interesting because his interactions with adults in particular, like the music teacher, are really interesting in that regard.
Yeah.
The music teacher also far too attractive to be an elementary school music teacher, although there is a reason for that.
There's
a really interesting cycle to the whole mythology of the piano of the forest, where it's like it kind of goes, even in this first volume, which is like a extra sized volume one, it's 300 pages, so it's like, you know, one and a half to two volumes otherwise, and it goes through multiple cycles of like, oh, that story's bullshit, to that story's true but not in the way you think it is, also not in that way, no, it's still bullshit. Oh no, there is a reason behind it. This reason seems bullshit. It kind of cycles around quite a way, which laying my cards on the table, I came out not really enjoying this series, but I did like how it handled that. with the, you know, the constant recycling of, you know, what is the actual truth of this dumbass piano? And that works well as like some a centrifuge to spin everything around and kind of collect you together. I will admit, I, Amamiya, do not care. Do not care. I, like, most of the emotional stuff in this volume, I did not care one whit, but Amamiya feels real bizarre because I can't, like, for me reading it, I can't tell whether he's supposed to be a main character or he is supposed to be the whole orbiting, boring character who introduces the real main character who is too complex to be a point of view character, in this case, Kai. Like, the Amamiya feels like the genericized, boring kid who is, like, I don't know, Goku's friend or something. Like, maybe it's just me, or maybe I'm analyzing it too closely to, like, writing craft. But it, I just couldn't get on with Amamiya. And even though I do like the part where he is torn between, well, do I like the piano? I mean, I play it well and people praise me for that. But I already know that my parents are pushing me into this and I kind of don't give a rat's bum. But at least I got a friend out of it. And Kai seems really cool and I will advocate for him. Meanwhile, my mum is going to be a complete helicopter parent. And so I kind of can't get behind Amamiya as a result. Because it always feels like whenever he's on screen, I just can't really jive with him, and I can't figure out if he's supposed to be just this boring, you know, sort of orbiting character or the point of view.
I think it's kind of a weird thing about this volume in particular, because it kind of raises things that I sort of want to progress through the series to see more of, and one of those things is, like, what are they actually going to do with Amamiya's character? Like, if anything, like you say, is he just going to be kind of the cipher that allows things to happen to other characters, or are they actually going to kind of progress and develop him? Because he seems to be set up in such a way that they should do that, but I'm not sure what they will or can do with that. And kind of likewise, the whole thing with, you know, the teacher and the origin story of this piano, like, it's kind of interesting, and I kind of like the way it's played out, and I feel like surely they're going to do a bunch of stuff with that, but I just can't really see in my mind's eye what that would be, which kind of puts me in this weird position where it's like, I kind of want to read more just to see what they do with this stuff, but also none of this that's been laid down is really compelling enough for me to, like, grab the next volume, like, obsessively and say, no, I really need to see what happens here.
Yeah, I'm with you, mostly because, if you write it down or say it out loud, like we are in this podcast, I feel like saying it out loud now and talking about it is more impactful than what I felt while reading it. Mm. Like, the piano teacher has a really quite horrible backstory, which is told in quite a, you know, rather flat fashion, rather sort of immediate fashion by the character himself. And it's like, man, this all sucks. This explains a lot. And at the same time, because you've barely seen him outside of basically kids yelling at him beforehand, I kind of couldn't bring myself to care that much. And, like, Kai is an interesting character, and he has his, like, rather sort of, you know, sort of his home life, which is non-standard, and everyone looks down on it because of it, but he doesn't care because whatever, I'm getting it done. His mum seems cool, wish we had more screen time from her, and she has her own story, clearly. Like, there's clearly a story behind what's going on with her. But at the same time, like, this volume is 300 pages, and I don't feel like any of it really made an impact on me.
Yeah.
Even in all that time, like, I a lot of things happened, but nothing really made a mark.
Yeah. I think I'm kind of with you on that as well. And the thing that kind of ultimately pushed me more a little into the negative column is the way that it handles Kai and his family ultimately. Like, it almost falls into the exact same trap as Kinpilla, as the show's bully, because the way it kind of depicts, like, the less well-off part of town is just, like, kind of cliched to the point of being offensive, where, like, everybody in that area of town is drunk and or stupid and or a prostitute, basically,
or a possible child rapist.
Yes, and yeah, I was gonna say, and that all culminates in an incredibly uncomfortable and really, really long attempted rape scene that has no need to be there and adds nothing to the story other than, like, oh wow, look at how horrible these poor people are. And it's like, really, is this really what you're doing, having, as you say, you, like, Kai's mum, when you see her, is like a pretty good character and you want to know more about her. And then it just kind of like reduces sort of that to a very sort of binary, like, oh wow, like, you know, look at all these awful poor people, like how bad it must be to be them, and look at these terrible things that they do. And it's like, this is almost exactly what the bully in the series is spouting, and then you're just kind of coming along and kind of reinforcing it in this way that you really shouldn't be.
Yeah,
that whole segment towards the end of that volume was just like, if that's kind of the heavy hand with which you're going to handle some of the kind of more interesting social angle of this series, then I am out. Like, I am not interested.
Yeah, it feels like it's definitely trying to talk out both sides of its mouth with that, because like nearly all of it, you know, presents Ray, Kai's mum, as being basically angelic and, you know, a woman taking her own life into her own hands. She's raising a child alone. She is a prostitute, but she doesn't let that define her. She's still her own person, you know. And at the same time, it then goes, yeah, but she's basically the one good person in this entire den of squalor and hell. And, you know, the fact that, like, there is that child, you know, attempted child rape scene, and the primary instigator is, like, the doctor who delivered Kai? It's like, yeah. What the fuck?
Yeah, it just adds a whole other layer. And it doesn't even really try to kind of, like, I kind of assumed it is going to play that off as just, like, you know, you're just drunk. It almost kind of does that, like, oh, this is just the drink talking. But then the character's right, was like, no, like, this is just what I do. And it's like every step where you could potentially walk it back even slightly, you then just double down on it. And it just, please stop.
Yeah, there's multiple points, as you say, where the doctor could have gone, ah, I'm kidding you, smacked Kai on the ass and been done. And then we could have moved on. But yeah, it's those sort of things that make it seem really discombobulated, especially with the social aspect, because one thing about it is it shows like the wrong side of the tracks, which is next to the piano forest, but you never see where that part of town interfaces with the rest of it, because every single shot is just of that part of town, you know, the bad part of town, the red light district. And it's like, well, we don't know how the rest of the town interfaces with it. This seems weird. Like, you've made a different plane of existence for Hookerland.
Yeah, well, that's the weird thing. It makes it feel as if that is the town. Like, it is literally just bars and strip clubs and brothels. And it's just like, you know, even the backstory of the prostitute ends up, the piano just ends up being like, oh, yeah, like, you know, this is where we banged the strippers. And it's like, there's like, this is not how this works. And like, you know, there is... If you're introducing a series that has these two characters, main characters from very different backgrounds, like if this is the subtlety in which you depict their differing worlds, then like, you know, there's not much hope for you in those terms.
Yeah, it makes the afterword feel quite strange, because it's by the author Makoto Ishiki's like editor at the time they were releasing the Tankerbons. And he says, oh yeah, when he first started, this creator said he could only do idiots and poor people. And it's like, well, you've made the idiots well, the school bully, but the poor people you've done badly. Yeah. And then the afterword goes in saying, oh, he's grown so much over this long series, you know. And it's an interesting afterword, really, because this, you know, this series took, you know, nearly two decades to come out in total, hiatuses included. So that's kind of fascinating, just in how long it took as a work to complete. At the same time, I don't really have an interest in reading more of it, especially because, like, in general, I feel like for 300 pages, I feel like it took a long time to get to anything in this volume. Like I get it. The school bully is a bully. He's gonna insult Kai, but you don't have to do that every chapter.
Yeah, it was a strange one for me kind of reading it, because like at no point did it really drag. Like, I didn't find myself looking at the page count thinking, oh man, I'm only halfway through. But at the same time, like, yeah, there also wasn't that feeling of kind of satisfaction at the end of like, oh yeah, like, you know, I've read something good, whether it's as a kind of like, that was cool, I don't want to read any more, or like, oh man, I need to read more of it. Like, it was very much there, and it's like, I feel I got more out of it just in terms of knowing that I could discuss it with you on this podcast, because it's an interesting series to talk about. But like, just as an isolated, I'm going to sit down and read this thing. Like, yeah, I kind of was left feeling blank and ambivalent about everything apart from kind of the back chapter or so that just annoyed me in how it handled its kind of, you know, social issues.
Yeah. I mean, one thing I'll admit is I looked ahead in Bookwalker to read the other synopses of the other other volumes. And I'm like, okay, all of these individual things sound interesting, but do I trust this series to do them anymore? Which sucks. Like, it's lame on my part to start second guessing a series before I continue reading it. I must admit, one thing about this release as well is that it has some color pages, and they look like hot garbage in this file, like in the digital release. They look awful. It kind of shocked me. I'm like, oh, this should look good, but it don't.
It's like, not normally the color pages are kind of the rarefied treat that you kind of luxuriate over. It's like, oh man, if only all of this could be in color. And that was very much a case of like, I hope I get to the black and white stuff soon, because hopefully it'll be a bit better. And like, generally I kind of like the art style of it. Like, it very much fits what that series is going for. Like, it works. I don't have anything kind of amazing to say about it, but like, it's functional. The character designs are good, and the piano looks nice.
The forest looks nice. The piano looks nice. When it takes a small dip into the slightly more fantastical realm of, you know, the power of music, it's like, yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, I get it. So, and not, you know, the backgrounds all look good, but the main thing is just that the only real locations we have at the moment are school, Amamiya's house, Skid Row, piano forest, and that's it.
It'd be like, if anybody listened to this has like read ahead in the series, it would be interesting to hear whether like the afterword about how the author grew during the creation of this series, kind of whether that actually holds water and bears fruit, or whether that's just like the editor like blowing smoke at the actual author, because I am curious about it, and I feel like I might watch the anime adaptation just to see what it does at some point, and that seems like a kind of an easier way to get into it. But yeah, like, I'm not overly kind of desperate to read more of it in manga form, I must admit.
Yeah, part of me feels like I'm fighting this impulse, but part of me feels like I should, like, I'm almost like, because I should continue it, because this manga has won awards and been talked about very positively. And I completely forgot about the Netflix show, because I went to the Wikipedia page and I was like, there's an anime series? Oh, it's on Netflix. Of course I didn't see it. You know, I don't have Netflix and I have very little visibility on that. So whoops. But no, I've heard good things about it, especially as like a work as a whole. But as a first volume, doesn't really sell me. At the moment, there are 7 volumes available in English. I think the English releases are either 2-volume omnibus or 1.5-volume sort of split. It's 26 volumes long in Japanese in total. It's completed in Japanese and has been since, I think, 2008. And it's still going in English. Kodansha just bunged out 7 volumes of it all in one go because they're the publisher. So I guess that's what they had ready. And we're just like, I don't know, sod it. So, yeah. It's digital only at the moment as well. Given that Kodansha have brought digital things physically, if they do well, who knows? Maybe that'll be in the future. It's quite a recent release. But yeah, that's Forest of Piano. Do you have anything else, Sandy?
No, I think that is all I have to say on that one.
Yeah, I enjoy speaking about it with you, I must admit. Because there are several things where it cycles around the piano itself, which interest me. Like, the history of the piano and the riddle of the piano is all good. Although now that's been answered, who knows what happens next?
Yeah. Again, I was surprised how quickly that came about, because I thought like, oh, this is going to be something that will at least last a few volumes. And that gets unveiled pretty quickly. It's like, oh no, this is why this thing is here. So it's like, oh, okay.
I must admit, when that was revealed, I was like, oh, I'm back in. Okay, fine. You know, I'll give you another chance. Because I got to page 200-ish of the volume, put it down because my tablet ran out of battery. And then once I charged it, I was like, I don't really want to read the rest of this. I was like, like petulant child Elliot. Cool. So that's Forest of Piano after that misfire. So moving on to my pick, I need to apologize. I forgot how crazy this was. It's Murcielago. I probably pronouncing that correct. It's a Spanish word for bat, also the name of a Lamborghini car. I found out. Thanks, manga. It's by Yoshimura Kana, being published by Yen Press. It's ongoing, both in Japan and here. 12 volumes out in Japan, 8 so far here in English. Volume 8 just came out this week. You can find it on Kobo, other good ebook stores. Apparently it's available physically, but I bet it's in shrink wrap. So this yeah god I don't want to think about it so I forgot how rough this was as a start. Volume one is, goes, but basically, Murcielago charts, or Kuroki, her Kuroki Kuroka? I forget her full name.
I think it's Kuroko Kumori.
Yes, Kuroko Kumori. So this is like approximately 7 foot tall, lanky, big breasted, long black haired psychopath who basically is let off of death row if she works for the state as basically a state sponsored executioner and person who goes and takes the cases that no one else wants to touch with a barge pole. So she's a member of the police in a weird way, and she has a little friend with her.
Hinako Suzuko.
Her weird friend Hinako, who in volume one is almost a human being, and if you continue through it, she starts to become more and more a bizarre, a hoge wielding chibi non-monster. More and more. But she's the supposedly calm, sensible one of the group, and they make a buddy cop sort of team as they go around taking on the cases anyone else wants to. The first case involves a roided up wrestler who has taken way too many roids and now thinks that anything and everything is a wrestling match, and he's trying his best to try and win back the hearts of people so they love wrestling again, except he's doing that by murdering the hell out of loads of people because he's gone completely to pot. And so you get the two main characters burying around the city in a Lamborghini, doing six stunts and trying to get take care of this menace to society while themselves doing a lot of property damage and themselves being a complete and utter menace to society. The main character, Kuroki, is also unstoppably horny constantly and is basically the ultimate sort of predatory lesbian as written by a man, basically. I bet this was written by a man. I don't know conclusively, but it's a really obvious seinen work. It's also a real wild whiplash after reading Bloom Into You, that's for sure, which is all about emotions and how you should feel. And then you've got Kuroki, who's just there with like a vibrator hidden down her tits. Also a bell, which that is actually like her boobs being a TARDIS is a joke that continues. So that's good. But yeah, it's really unhinged. It's really violent. It's really gross. Like, you get quite a few people who've had their bottom halves removed and, oh, you're not going to do so well, my friend. Sorry, I can't help you. Your bottom half is missing. Check it out. But yeah, I feel kind of bad for recommending this, Andy, because I forgot that basically page three is just hardcore lesbian sex straight off the bat. Unforgiving, like just boosh right there. So don't read it on the bus. But I do like the series mostly because I enjoy the interplay and the sort of politicking. Once it gets beyond the first case, it gets into politicking of this place of, you know, very clearly a country gone a bit loopy and lots of violent and reprehensible crimes going on. And, you know, oh, the only way to solve this problem is to get another problem on the case. Dun, dun, dun. And the main thing I like about it, honestly, like, even if I'm being prudish and a bit squeamish, is the art. Because it has a lot of really fascinating paneling work and active movement. Like, the series never feels like it's sitting still, and it's not like it's just being restless and moving for no point. You know, it's always moving forward. The car is always moving, the characters are always moving, someone's always moving, someone's whipping out a gun or twirling around or tilting their head in like the ultimate shaft head tilt, or basically just whirling around constantly. So the series has a great feeling of momentum. The art looks kind of crazy good, even if sometimes it feels misapplied because it's done to show a lot of intestines. But no, I really enjoy that sort of real feeling of just lush movement. It almost feels like it's been released at the wrong time, and it should have come out as like a Cyber City Oedo style OAV in the 80s bubble economy. I'm almost shocked that something like this doesn't already exist in the bubble economy OAV space. But at the same time, I really enjoy it for just the complete madcap violence. And admittedly, I've read past volume one, and it sounds kind of lame, but it starts to settle down in volume two onwards, which is a blessing because you can only stand 140 mile an hour plotline for so long. But yeah, and also one thing about it is that it does overstep the bounds with violence quite a few times. I mean, I'm the sort of person who goes, oh, Elfin Lied is garbage, because it is, but also because it's so gleeful about its violence, where I feel like Murcielago goes up to a limit, but doesn't quite step over the line of violence is or it, you know, violence that really shouldn't be there. Like, there's plenty of violence and a lot of it's quite gross and some of it involving innocent bystanders, but it feels like it's all within this strange other world of, yeah, this is, everything's gone to pot and this is kind of not even the worst you're gonna see. Maybe that's just me, but now I've tried to justify it preemptively and with apologies. What did you think of it, Andy?
kind of to echo your thoughts, like my first feelings after having read like the first chapter or so of this was like, why is this not an anime already? Because it felt like I was reading the storyboards for a Trigger show. Like, it has that.
Oh, don't ruin it. No.
Gridman is good. Like, Trigger are okay again now.
But I also but I don't trust Trigger that much. So.
No, but like, it's more just like in terms of what you were talking about with the energy that this series has and the amount of kind of movement in everything. Like, it kind of reminded me of kind of Trigger shows where like there's always something moving or going on, like in a way that is sort of often counter to like anime in particular, where they're trying to kind of rein in the budgets. Like, this feels like a series that's just so kind of vibrant, and it just felt like I was reading storyboards. And again, kind of like coming off the back of our last podcast where like I talked about Mushroom Girls in Love and how like nothing felt like it had any kind of movement or fluidity to it, like this is the exact opposite, where like you say, everything is kind of bouncing around on screen in inverted commas, like all the time. Like, there's a really good example of that is in that first case where they're kind of rocking around in that sports car. Like, there's a few panels where they're just kind of driving down this narrow, like, back alley, basically. And, like, I feel like in the hands of other artists, like, it would just be like, hey, here's the car, here's the narrow street, here you go. Like, that's all you need. Whereas here, like, you've got the wing mirrors scraping down kind of the sides of this narrow alley. There's kind of rubbish and stuff being kind of, like, you know, chucked around and run over as it goes along its way. And there's just this like feeling of kind of motion all the time. And I really enjoyed that. Like, that's to pull that off in manga and to do it kind of constantly like that feels actually like quite an impressive feat. But, you know, nothing is ever still. And even in just kind of like talking head scenes, it's like there's always something, whether like you say, it's like Kuriko's just like cracking her neck, or I'm pretty sure like her head tilt is just simply to get her into the panel because she's so tall half the time. Like, it seems like she just does this whole thing where she just has to keep tilting her head just so that she fits into the scene, which I really like.
Yeah, the author's just like, ah, oh, shit, I made her too tall.
But I also
like her being tall. And so, yeah, it feels like it's very much a thing they're doing in service of it. And also, yeah, the amount of hair she has. Yeah, Kuroko's a ridiculous character from beginning to end.
Yeah, it feels like one of those things that at some point is going to kind of turn into like an afterward or like a four-panel comic at the end of a volume, and be like, yeah, I've made a real mistake designing this character because this is terrible. It's kind of like the recap episode of the Recreators anime where they complain about all the stuff they've done with the main character design that makes her really difficult to draw. Like, I feel like there's probably a Murcielago equivalent of that, where it's like, yeah, these are all the things we should never have done because this makes this really hard. But yeah, I don't know. I really like all of that stuff. Like, I like how violent it is in the way that it kind of, like, I am one of the many people who is kind of responsible for the overuse of the word visceral, but this series is actually visceral. Like, it fits the bill there. Yeah. And it kind of, like, it feels like it should be. Like, it makes no apologies of the fact. I mean, it kind of, I really like the way the series starts with this kind of weird, kind of dark montage of like all these murders that Kuroko has committed. And this sort of like, it's basically like inside her headspace for the first page where it's just like murder, just like over and over again. And then it kind of very matter-of-factly says like, yeah, this person's like murdered 715 people. And I kind of wish it would keep that count up throughout the series just so that we can kind of stay appraised, but maybe that's asking too much. But like, you know, it kind of, It just fits what the series is doing. Like, it's very open to the fact that, like, yeah, this is it's a little Black Lagoon-esque in the sense that, like, it's like, yeah, here's this kind of seedy underworld full of terrible people, and the only way to get anything done here is to hire more terrible people to do equally terrible things. And it's I was going to say, like, you can argue like the morality and the logic of that as much as you like, but in terms of making kind of a no holds barred action series, like, that works, and you know, I can't really argue with that.
Yeah, I have a note. Basically, in my notes, I have two different notes about the setting and just how the characters operate. But basically, one of them I have is that, like, you know, Kuroko is basically, you know, Revy if people didn't know when to stop.
Yeah.
It's like with Revy, you have an interesting, fascinating character who, you know, can bust out of a pair of pistols and totally get shit done. With Kuroki, they just kind of went ham and never stopped. And I think I've had a listening to you there. One thing that I think I mentioned very quickly in passing, and now I feel a bit more strongly about, is that, like, they like the characters that you see and all the stuff that happens is in this hyper real fucked up space where, you know, they are the part of the police that look into cruel and unusual crimes. That is their department. And then whenever any of that stuff intersects with real people or bystanders, it immediately escalates to, oh man, all these normal people are utterly out of their depth, and this is why they've hired this crazy lady. It's because she can keep these things separate and, you know, take care of these complete psychopaths. You know, it's like, you know, like Batman supervillain style problems of like, oh, this guy is clearly out of the range of anything normal. Because look at it. So that's kind of the thing where, you know, whenever reality and real people intersect with it, it's like, oh, they get turned into paste, because they would. I mean, even there's one part where some like drug dealers try and threaten Kuroki, and she's just like, fuck off. Like, do you know how crazy I am?
Yeah. Like, I mean, she's basically like, you really don't want to do this. You should probably stop. And they're like, why? What are you going to do? It's like, well, fine, I'll show you. And then basically just murders everybody.
Yeah. And then murders all three of them. And she even scolds one of them for not being able to say gang rape without stuttering.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, all of that stuff, it sits on that weird spectrum where you can kind of go to the point where you're so over the top that it kind of becomes okay again in a weird sort of way. Like, it kind of, there's a point here where this could have just like had all this violence and it would have been like the elfin lead route of like, well, this is just gratuitous, but somehow it goes so far on it that it just kind of swings back around again to kind of making sense within this world and kind of like feeling like, maybe justified isn't the right word, but it kind of like it has a reason for being that you can kind of like say, sure, okay, in this series, fine, that all makes sense.
Yeah, there's an exuberance to it which really helps. Like, you know, there's enough, I feel, with the like side chapters and the characters in particular that kind of, you know, it winks, like it knows it's a fictional construct and goes, look, let's just go on this ride, check it out, I drew this car, I then wrecked the car and felt bad because drawing it while broken up is way hard. So yeah, it kind of works in that regard. And also just like, you know, just the fact that you have other characters looking on going, well, this isn't ideal, but whatever. But yeah, all the action scenes, as I say, are real good fun. Like, there's lots of good character movement and just, you know, spatial awareness. Like, as I say, I've read ahead and there's some even better stuff of just, you know, real smart sort of combat sequences.
I think the only aspect of the series of in this first running that I kind of got a bit tired of is Kuroko's kind of constant horniness, because like, to start with, it's like, it's fine, and it's kind of, I mean, it's a really good gag in places. Like, there's one point during this whole like car chase scene where she's like, whoa, stop the car, because she like wants, well, they end up like rescuing some girl from some thugs, and then like basically while all this other shit is going down, Kuroko's just like, look, hang on a minute, I need to get her phone number. And like, that's a really good gag, both kind of visually and in terms of like the plotting and the pacing of it, because it slams on the brakes for just long enough to give the audience a breather and to be a pretty good little joke. And then it kind of almost seems like it's offering up a weird kind of like plot hook for a future volume, and then it goes on. And like, I really liked little bits like that, but it felt like at some points it was just trying to shoehorn Kuroko's proclivities into kind of almost every other panel. And it was just like, okay, I get it, you could probably stop now.
Yeah, I'm not going to say it ever stops that, because it kind of doesn't, but what it does do is find ways to make it coexist more happily with everything else that's going on. Like, generally it tends to surface when Kuroko has like enough spare brain space to actually consider it. Like, when stuff gets real, she doesn't then start trying to stop and go, hey, hey, hey. So, you know, she's still a complete horn dog and basically is led around by her groin. But at the same time, she is very much a case of like, okay, no, this I will try and cop a feel if I can, but if I must, I will be serious for a second here.
Yeah, yeah, because that's the stuff that kind of feels like it works better in this first volume, but then, yeah, sometimes it kind of like it seems like it homes in on that above all else, which kind of culminates in like the bonus part of this first volume, which is just like a really gross, like Kuroko goes on a dating site as a guy and then turns up to date this girl. It's like, oh, by the way, I'm a girl. And she's like, oh, okay, sure, well, let's go to a love hotel. And it's like you say, like, clearly this feels like it was written by a man, because like that's not how this goes down or should.
Yeah, it does definitely feel like a very much a weird like roundabout power fantasy sort of thing, sexual power fantasy with that. It's weird. I can imagine it turning people off completely and utterly. And I feel like it gets up to that line for me, and then it kind of just goes, and then, you know, kind of makes itself goony enough for me to forgive it, although still feel kind of rough. I must admit, like, I completely, also that's the stuff I don't remember about the series when I was recommending it. When I recommended this, I was like, oh, it's the one with the Lamborghini and the massive wrestler and the crazy sidekick and, you know, tall girl. And then reading it back, I'm like, oh man, there's a lot of sex in this. Shit.
Yeah, yeah. Which, like, yeah, I'm fine with that. It's just at times it kind of over-eggs it. I mean, I'm kind of interested by the fact that you've sort of said that, like, Hinako's character changes, because that was certainly one of my notes of just like, I literally just wrote in all caps, like, who is she? Because like, we get all of Kuroko's backstory is like, yeah, she's crazy murderer turned state sponsored execution, but then there's just this like cute sidekick girl who happens to be really good at driving and kind of mapping stuff in her brain. And it's like, what's her deal? Like, she's also terrible at drawing. Like, I want to know more about her. So like, if that actually gets revealed in an interesting way, that would be kind of a hook for me to read more of it for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's probably an unsurprising thing, given you can imagine this happening, but it turns out that Hinako is the more fascinating character in terms of backstory and what her fucking deal is. I'm in volume 3 and it started to slowly peel that back. At the same time, it's like, this is going to be painful at some point when they actually do pull the plaster off and show you the exact backstory of what her deal is. Even just now, I've only had bits and pieces of it, so God knows.
Well, yeah, that sounds interesting, at least, because I felt like this is a series that's either just going to keep her as just like complete mystery, or they would kind of delve into her, and I find myself just wanting to know a bunch more about her, because she is just kind of great, not least because she gets distracted by cats in the middle of missions, and I think we can all appreciate
yeah,
that.
For a second. I wrote that bit down as well. That's important. But yeah, there is one thing that the series starts to do in later volumes. It starts to incorporate Kuroki is part of this broader police scope, which I'm kind of a bit out to lunch on, but yeah, it's interesting at least.
Cool. But yeah, I mean, overall, like, I enjoyed the series. I think it kind of came at the right time for me, because I think there was a gap in my sort of stuff that I'd read and watched where I hadn't had any kind of like Black Lagoon-esque kind of crazy over the top bloody action series for quite a while, and it was something that I think I was probably jonesing for it without knowing. And so as soon as this started and kind of the blood and guts started flying, it's like, oh yeah, I've kind of been needing something like this for a little while. So this has come along at the right time for me.
As a side note, guess what's now available digitally? Black Lagoon, as it turns out.
Yeah, I did see that, because I don't think I've read like the latest volume of that, because when it kind of came back. So I should probably get back on that train at some point.
Yeah, I think the author's coming back to it fully. They keep pausing to do other stuff and recreate it and such. So it's like, a few people have been like tweeting it angrily, going, come on. And it's like, hey, they're busy, you know.
Yeah, but yeah, like more Black Lagoon, also much appreciated.
Yeah, more Black Lagoon, shorter Black Lagoon, honestly. Man, okay, that's a different conversation. I'm going to cut that off before I ramble on. Cool. So yeah, that's Mercy Lago. I was really fearful, actually, of you coming on going, what the fuck did you make me read? And it's like, oops.
No, I'm not as pure and innocent as all of that. So yeah, I was like, okay, yeah, I'm this, go for it.
Yeah I'm but then again, like I say, like reading it a second time, I'm like, man, this moves. Like, it's fun to have that kind of like,
I've got to admit, when I got to that like early page that was being sex, it's just like, is this actually the show Elliot recommended? Have I downloaded the wrong thing? I did have to like do a double take and just double check that I wasn't reading something completely different.
Oops. Dear me. Yeah, I've just renamed like Hot Titties Volume 16 as Mercy Lago Volume 1 for real. You know, EPUB. Oh dear. Cool. So moving on. What are we going to talk about next time? So for next episode, next fortnight. I have just gone down the bewitching dark path of light novels, which I've picked another light novel, which, not wanting to prejudge anything, I've already read it and would like to know what you think about it, Andy. But I've picked My Next Life is a Villainous, All Roots Lead to Doom, Volume 1. It's available on J Novel Club. I took out a subscription with them to start reading that and some other stuff that is in our bonus episode for November. So yeah, that's what I've picked out for us. It's split into 10 parts. Each part can be very comfortably, easily read. So that's hopefully not too much of a burden. And how about you, Andy?
Cool. Yeah. So rather than the whole light novel thing, I picked a different kind of torture, that being having to buy an actual physical book. Shock horror, like in insert gasps of distraught distraughtness here. My favorite manga of last year was My Lesbian Experience with Loneliness, which is an incredible piece of work that everybody should read.
Yep.
But annoyingly, like, the follow-up My Solo Exchange Diary is not available digitally, and having sat around for a while waiting and hoping that it might come about digitally, I became impatient, and so My Solo Exchange Diary Volume 1 in its physical form is my pick, because I really, really need to read that thing.
So I actually already bought it and read it physically, even though I have my staunch digital-only thing, because I kept messaging Seven Seas on Twitter going, hey, digital, and they just went, nope, no plans, and it's like, okay, fine. So I when I was at SLA Edinburgh, I went into the Forbidden Planet and bought it there. I just cracked. I thought, no, I gotta read this, I gotta have this. Like, My Lesbian Experience of Loneliness is like something beyond, it's amazing. So I was like, fine, I'm buying the next thing. And the one thing I didn't know actually is it's going to be continuing. I thought it was another just one shot thing, not a volume one, so that makes me even more excited.
Yeah, I'm not sure how many volumes there are in total or whether it's even finished, but yeah, I know there are a few volumes.
Yeah, I don't believe it's finished, but I don't want to say it too conclusively in case I'm wrong. But yeah, so we're going to be reading those. So thank you very much for listening. We're in the close down section. You can listen to other podcasts and catch the notes and time codes on our website, screentone.club. Podcast can be, of course, be found on Apple Podcasts, etc. If you liked this podcast, please consider telling a friend. It's kind of the easiest and best way of it spreading and getting more listeners. If you do like the podcast, you can also consider maybe leaving a review on your podcatcher app of choice. That stuff really helps with discoverability and the algorithms. You can see our Twitter at Screentone Club, where you can see us tweet out pictures and stuff, and more and more me sort of lament my continuing inability to stop myself from purchasing yet more manga. You can also email us. You can send it to show@screentone.club. Legit email, swear to God, it works. I've tested it and everything. But no, on a personal site for me, you can find what I do on moesh.it and also mangasir.ch, which is a legal digital manga search engine, which should have fixed CSS soon once I can do that. And you can find me on Twitter at Elliot Page, all one word. And Andy, sorry, how about you?
Yeah, you can also find me on Twitter, where I am at Hannah's1979.
Woo. So yeah, thank you very much for listening. And we will see you again, speak to you again soon. Good night.
Bye, everyone.